Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm happy to say we have Norman Neymark on the show, and we'll be talking about his thought-provoking new book, Stalin's Genocides. Almost everybody would agree that Stalin was guilty of mass murder. Fewer of us, I think, would say that he was guilty of genocide. In this book, Norman Neymark makes the case that we are wrong in this and that we should actually say that Stalin was, just as Hitler and Pol Pot and others, guilty of the international crime of genocide. He offers some very interesting arguments. One of them I didn't know was that after World War II, the Soviets and other countries adjusted the definition so as to exclude social and political elements. In any event, I really enjoyed talking to Norman today, and I think that you'll enjoy the interview. So without further ado, here it is. Hi, Norman.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm just fine. Thank you very much.
Good. Well, thanks for being on the show. I should tell our listeners that we're talking to Norman Neymark, who is a distinguished member of my field, Russian history, and he's written a really terrific new book called Stalin's Genocides. I have read the book completely. It very forcefully argues, as we'll talk about later in the interview, that we should consider Stalin's crimes genocides under international law. And Norman has some very interesting things to say about that. As I say, we'll come to all that in due time. But Norman, why don't we begin the interview by having you just say a few words about yourself?
Well, I was born in New York. I'm an army brat, so I grew up pretty much all over the world and then went to Stanford as an undergraduate and loved it so much I stayed as a graduate student. And then when I got my PhD, I headed off to Boston for 15 years, where I was at Boston University and at the Russian Research Center at Harvard, and then came to Stanford in 1987-88 and have been here ever since.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So things have come full circle for you.
Yes, they have, and I'm very happy about it. I enjoy the West Coast. I enjoy Northern California, and Stanford's a wonderful institution.
And how did you decide to study Russian and Eastern European history?
Well, there's a mix of reasons that I decided to go into this particular field. One of them had to do with an interest as an undergraduate in the left, meaning in Marxism and in Leninism and all those kinds of things that were very tantalizing, you know, to undergraduates in the 60s, as I was. And I was very interested in the Soviet Union. It seemed strange and distant and in some ways forbidding. You know, just the sheer, I think, exoticism of it attracted me to the field. And then I had some wonderful professors. Well, one in particular, Wayne Glisnevich, was a mentor and a friend. He was a Balkanist, so that accounts for the fact that I worked both in Eastern European and in Russian history. And at some point he said, why don't you go to graduate school? And I said, that sounds like an interesting idea. I said, how do I do that? And he said, well, why don't you stay here? So I just continued. And fortunately for me, you know, it really fit. It took me a while to figure out that this was really something that, you know, I was fully committed to. But eventually, like I said, it turned out to be a very good fit because I love teaching and I love research. So it's been just great.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting story. I always ask people how they got into the field that they entered, and I invariably hear something interesting about that. So maybe you could say a few words about how you came to write Stalin's Genocides.
Okay, well, this has actually been a project. The book, as you know, let me just take a step back. The book, as you know, is a kind of extended essay, and I've been really thinking about these issues having to do with Stalin and his crimes on the one hand and the history of genocide on the other hand for a long time. I mean, I wrote this book in 2001, I published a book in 2001 called Fires of Hatred, which was about ethnic cleansing and genocide. And at that point, you know, I was trying to deal with the history of genocide and with issues of comparative genocide. And, so I was interested in both areas, in other words. Well, one, the genocide history, the history of the Genocide Convention, how we deal with genocide. And on the other hand, with Stalin and with a lot of the new materials that were coming out on Stalin. So, and I asked myself the question, you know, why is it that Soviet historians in particular are so resistant to putting Stalin, you know, in this history of genocide? And why is it that sometimes historians of genocide leave out, the crimes of Stalin? So that was my motivation, was to try to put these things together. And I came to the conclusion, and, you know, it's really, as I say, an essay, an argument that I make. And I understand that they're counter-arguments, and I try to recognize the validity of those in the book. But it seems to me there's a powerful argument to be made that Stalin's crimes should be considered genocide. So that's, you know, that's really the genesis of the book. And with that conviction then, I wrote a couple of essays on the subject, and then a German publisher, Surkampf, asked me to come to Berlin to give a lecture on the subject, and said they would publish it and to turn in as much as I wanted to. And I thought, well, that's a good opportunity just to sit down and kind of write out what it is I was thinking and to do some more reading. And, as you probably know, there's a huge literature now coming on the 1930s, and a very good literature. So it gave me the opportunity just to sit down, read some of that literature, and try to write out what it was I was thinking about this subject. And then I gave it to a friend who said, well, let's publish it. This is Eric Weitz, who suggested I publish it at Princeton as well in English. So that's the genesis of this project.
I see. That gives us a lot of material to talk about. I want to begin by going back to something you said earlier, and that is that Soviet historians and some historians of genocide, but let's concentrate on the Soviet historians, have been resistant to the idea that we should classify Stalin's crimes as genocide. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's several reasons, and it depends. You know, one has to be careful, you know, not to overgeneralize about these kinds of things. I think several reasons pertain. One is, I think that any historians of any period like to think of what they're studying as somehow unique and different. So by putting Stalin's crimes in a kind of genocide category, it tends to, I think for some historians of the Soviet Union, it tends to equate Stalin with Hitler, make it too easy to use the totalitarian model. They like the particularity. The historians always like the particularities of their subjects and their specificities. And indeed, there are specificities of the Soviet 30s. So I think that's one of the reasons. I think another reason has to do with how one thinks of Stalin's policies in the 30s. And, you know, we have colleagues who believe, and again, I don't want to at all minimize their talent or assiduousness when I say this, who think that, you know, what Stalin did in the 30s was in some measure a preparation for the war, that the external threats to the Soviet Union, which were there in the 30s, you know, dictated that he had to engage in some of these actions. Now, they will say these are brutal, awful, terrible actions that he killed unnecessarily, but it's hard for the same historians to call this genocide, because genocide is really the crime of crimes. It's the worst, you know, crime you can commit in the international judicial system. And a crime of crimes can have no justification. In other words, it can't be a means to an end of something else in a kind of rational fashion. And I think that's hard for some of our colleagues to accept, that there was no reason, that there was no means to an end, that this was killing, you know, of a genocidal sort, which had no, you know, kind of rational basis to it. So, for example, this war scare argument is one that's used very broadly by Soviet historians to sort of say, okay, this is why this happened. Other people talk a lot about the modern, you know, and when I was a graduate student, we used to talk about the modernization argument. In other words, Russia needed to be modernized. In order to be modernized, everywhere modernization is accompanied by some violence. And therefore, the violence, in other words, is contextualized and somehow rationalized instead of being seen as what it is, which I think is, you know, just criminal violence. So those are some of the arguments that are made. You know, there are other arguments made, too, that there were real conspiracies against Stalin, you know, that Trotsky and the Fourth International was seen as a danger to Stalin. So I think this is part of the story, too. Mm-hmm. And then the final thing is, I mean, it's not the final thing, but yet another factor, I think, in all of this, for some people, not for all, is the kind of residual progressivism that Stalin somehow represents to people. In other words, Stalin was a figure in the history of Marxism in some ways. And some people have actually used Stalin as a way to say Marxism was rotten at the core. By the way, I wouldn't do that necessarily, but, you know, some people do that. So there's this, you know... as I say, kind of residual desire to give Stalin some credit, some due, as a Marxist, as a Marxist-Leninist, in some fashion as a progressive. I think a lot of this is disappearing, but certainly before the fall of the Soviet Union, and still to some extent, you know, there is this kind of sense that we don't want to put Stalin in the same category with rightists like Hitler, you know, like those kinds of killers. Mm-hmm. So these reasons and others, I think people are hesitant, you know, to take up this argument and hesitant to accept it. And I expect a lot of critique, you mm-hmm. know, of the argument. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's actually launch into the argument itself and begin by talking about the origins of the notion of genocide itself. We've discussed this a little bit on the show before in a couple of contexts, but I think it bears rehearsing again. Where do we get the word genocide, and how did it achieve a international legal definition?
Okay, well, the story has now become increasingly familiar, which is good. In other words, more and more people are writing about it. And let me just try to summarize my take on how this went. You know, there was this wonderful and fascinating character, Raphael Lemkin, a Polish Jew who came to the United States in 1940. Lemkin had already developed a concept of what he called barbarism, in the early 1930s, in which he talked about the elimination, you know, of ethnic, national, religious, social, and political groups as, you know, deserving the name of an international crime. And he tried to convince the League of Nations, you know, to pass some sort of laws in this connection. In other words, Lemkin had already come up with the concept before he came up with the name. So he came to the United States, it was after the Nazi invasion of Poland, so it was 1940, eventually 41, you know, worked in Washington, D.C., was watching what was going on in Europe, was shocked by the fact that his actual concept of barbarism had come, you know, into being in some ways with the horrible Nazi occupation and the killing of Jews and Poles and others. And he came up in the book called The Axis Occupation of Europe in 1944 with a concept of genocide. I mean, he looked for a word to describe what he had in mind, and he called it genocide. Now, in his book in 1944, Lemkin limited the definition of genocide. You know, to national, ethnic, religious, and racial groups. In other words, he himself left out social or political groups out of his definition. I think this was partly out of, you know, his deep despair. His own family was involved about what was going on in Europe at the time. You know, the Nazi crimes were what, again, what he had in mind now when he talked about genocide. And those crimes were clearly crimes against, you know, ethnic and religious minorities, national minorities, and national groups like the Poles or Russians. So his term genocide in some ways stuck. And it stuck because, in part because of his own persistence. You know, he went to Nuremberg. He lobbied for the use of the term. He lobbied for all kinds of things. And he was a very interesting man and very committed to this notion of getting the laws passed. So he didn't have much luck at Nuremberg. I mean, Nuremberg was much more interested in punishing aggressive war than it was in dealing with the fact that Jews and Poles have been eliminated. And so he continued his lobbying at the United Nations, and it worked. It basically worked. Although the first drafts of the Genocide Convention, I mean, the first drafts, the first discussions included social and, in particular, political groups. So that the original exclusive definition, which was just the, you know, the killing of national and ethnic religious groups. Again, if you think about it, national and ethnic are different from religious. I mean, religious is much more an ascriptive category. You know, mm-hmm. You can change your religion one day to the next very easily. But in any case, that definition was the definition that was finally inscribed in the December 48 UN Convention. And I make the argument in the book that the reason that political and social groups were eliminated from that definition had a lot to do with a political compromise with the Soviet Union and its allies in Eastern Europe. And by the way, this included, remember, Ukraine and Belarus, which at that time were considered, had individual votes in the UN. They insisted that the mentions of political or social groups be eliminated from the Genocide Convention. And it's pretty clear that what happens is the United States, I mean, Great Britain, interestingly, I mean, there's a very good book on Lemkin by John Cooper, which I didn't have a chance to read before I wrote my own, in which he argues very convincingly that Great Britain was also opposed to the convention as a whole. But this was the Soviet Union in particular that eliminated social and political groups in the Genocide Convention. Then, you know, for a long time, the genocide was basically forgotten about in the sense that, you know, although the sufficient number of UN members ratified it, you know, the U.S. hadn't ratified the convention. People didn't pay much attention to it. And it really took, in some ways, the 1990s and the horrible things that happened there in terms of the killings in Bosnia, genocide in Rwanda in 1994, that got people thinking again about genocide, about its importance, about its applicability, and about its relevance to international law and also to the international system as a whole. So that's, in short, the history of our use of the term genocide. As you know now, it's a term that's bandied about all the time and that some people misuse and abuse. Everybody wants to be recognized as the victim of genocide. And I think, you know, I think it's important you know, to keep our eyes on the fact that this is the crime of crimes, that it's mass murder, you know, on a terrible scale. But I also believe that Stalin's killings, and also, you know, we should think about the killings in China and Cambodia and other places where governments, political leaders essentially kill off groups of their own population, substantial numbers of their own population, should be considered genocide as well. And that's a major part of the argument of the book.
I see. That was a very good introduction. Let me ask, before we proceed to talk about Stalin and Stalin's crimes in detail, let me ask the following question. There are political scientists, of course, who study these things, and they have what is really a kind of stock term for them. It is not genocide or even mass murder. It's democide. Have you ever heard this term? You have. You mentioned it in the book. Why don't we just call it democide or something similar?
Okay. Well, my view of this, academics are wonderful at making up terms that they enjoy using. And, sort of the idea is, in some senses, to talk to ourselves. There's been democide. There's classicide. I've seen ethnocide. I mean, a lot of people would like to create new sort of classifications for killing that would leave, in other words, the genocide concept intact or not use it at all. In other words, some scholars believe that genocide is so tainted by its judicial meanings, its legal meanings, that historians and social scientists, shouldn't use it at all. I absolutely disagree with that. I mean, my view of this is that, historians, scholars, social scientists need to speak, to a larger world in which, terms are used in a particular way that makes sense to people. So, genocide is something we know. Genocide is something we deal with. It's with the press deals with it. Public intellectuals deal with it. Congress deals with it when it tries to pass, a genocide resolution having to do with the Armenian genocide. You start messing around. with creating a whole series of new terms, I think you basically lose the fact that you live in a real world where somebody like this, president of Sudan, has been indicted for genocide by, the international court, and you understand broadly what that means. I think that using new terms, may make things more precise in some fashion and, chop the onion up in different pieces. But my basic view is it's the same onion, if you will. I don't know if that's a good metaphor or not, but I mean, but you see what I mean. In other words, I think we ought to use the terms that are out there that are being used by people, by pundits, by everyone, as a way to join a larger discussion about the problem of genocide in the modern world.
So let's actually move on and talk about Stalin himself. The second chapter of your book, I found it really interesting. One of the things historians really like to do is look back at people's biographies after the fact and find things in them that would suggest that their activities in the future, so to say, are predictable. That is, we'll look at Hitler or something and say, oh, yes, well, it's predictable. He hated Jews or Stalin. Is there anything in Stalin's biography that would tell us that he was going to kill millions of his own, I guess I'd call them subjects?
My own view of this problem is one that is more, long durée when it comes to Stalin. In other words, I don't think there are any secrets to Stalin's brutality. I mean, it could be, I have to say, it could be, something physiological that we just don't and will never know about, meaning he was missing a part of the brain where fundamentally people are empathetic with others and care about the suffering and death of others. Because we know from everything we read, we know about him, and we now know a heck of a lot more about him than we knew before 1991. When the archives were completely closed. I mean, we know he had no empathy whatsoever for the people he destroyed, and that he was perfectly happy, perfectly willing to destroy, you know, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people without, you know, blinking an eyelash. So without having any regrets whatsoever. That much we know. So who knows? There could be something physiological that explains that, you know, barring any understanding of that, which we will probably never have. You know, if you go back to his biography, some people have located, you know, his brutality in his very early youth, which is to say his father was a drunk and used to beat him up. But, you know, looking, when I took a look at this material, and by the way, I relied primarily on other people's biographies, and there have been a lot of them, and they've been very good. And then I looked at the best, you know, the best material I could on this. You know, I came to the conclusion that there really isn't anything that would, you know, be a key to explaining this man's brutality. And instead, it's cumulative, is what I argue, over time. But there are many things. I mean, he did not have a particularly happy youth, although, you know, his mom loved him and, you know, was completely dedicated to him. But, you know, you go to his schooling and you see that the man was a poet and he loved to sing. In addition, you know, to reading radical literature in the seminary, which pretty much everybody did all over the Russian Empire in similar educational situations, especially in the borderlands. And, you know, he came into the Bolshevik movement, as you know, which was the most radical, you know, of the underground movements. He immediately attached himself to Lenin, who was the most, aggressive and authoritarian, you know, of the underground leaders. You know, his role in the revolution was a very important one. But I don't think he showed any more proclivity towards violence there than other Bolsheviks, who were a pretty violent crew. You know, some people have located his violence in the Russian Civil War. And you look at what he did on the Tsaritsyn Front, and indeed, you know, there are really examples of some fairly cold and cruel activity. But again, nothing out of the ordinary. So, you know, I think what happens is that gradually, you know, this willingness to use violence accumulates. And then in the power struggle in the 20s, you know, which is a very, I mean, it's not overtly violent, but it has a kind of political violence to it, meaning people aren't killed or hurt in the 20s, but there's a very kind of a fierce attention on Stalin's part to accumulating power. You know, so by the beginning of the 30s, you know, this fierceness, this focus, you know, and also this, you know, craftiness and in some senses intelligence, you know, accumulates to the point where I think he's just ready, you know, ready to use violence. And then de-kulakization, you know, you see the first sort of real instance of mass violence. You know, not necessarily ordered by him in a particular way that comes later, but an unleashing of violence you know, he's ready to see others use violence or to see violence used to accomplish the aims of collectivization. Mm-hmm. And I think it just simply accumulates. Mm-hmm. So that would be my answer, that it's cumulative. And that you can't point to one instance, but that you can point to a number of places along the way where, you know, there's a kind of escalation of the commitment to use violence against his own people that, you know, that don't bode well for the future. I mean, you can't predict what's going to happen, right? But that prepare him as a genocidaire.
Mm-hmm. So before we move on to talk about the crimes themselves, let me ask you what used to be the big question in Soviet history. I don't know if it is anymore. And that is the question of continuity between Lenin and Stalin. You remember these debates. It was really quite all the rage. What do you think? Is there something of Stalin's crimes in the Leninist period or in Lenin, or is Stalin a real departure?
That's still, I think, an important question, especially when thinking about Stalin and genocide in particular, because I would not put Lenin in the category of a genocidaire. You need to try to distinguish between the two. Lenin obviously was someone who was ready to use violence, who had people killed, who, strung up people, peasants in Tambov, just for the purpose of showing the other peasants that they shouldn't rebel as well. So there's nothing, we're not talking about a pacifist by a long shot when we talk about Lenin. Nevertheless, it's my view, and I understand that there are other views of this that might be different and that have a certain point to them. It's my view, looking at all this material on Stalin, that once again, there was some relationship between means and ends with Lenin. You want to stop a peasant uprising. You kill peasants and string them up, as I say, on the hillocks in the neighborhood, and the other peasants won't rebel. You shoot a certain number of socialist revolutionaries, and you let the rest go abroad. They flee for their lives, basically. So what I'm saying about Lenin is that violence had a very particular, in my view, again, violence had a relationship to the goals which he had in mind. There was a kind of, there's a principle in law which I think is called the reasonable man or something like that, where you talk about somebody shooting an intruder in your house. Well, the reasonable man might well do this in some circumstances. But if he's sitting in a tree on the outside of your house, a reasonable man is not going to shoot him, right? So similarly, you can understand Lenin's violence in the context in which he worked and lived. This is how I would look at it.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Stalin's violence, it seems to me, was gratuitous, unnecessary, and had no reasonable relationship to the problems he wanted to solve.
Mm-hmm.
In something like collectivization, or something like if there was a sniff that something was wrong in the army. What he does is kill, as masses of people,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
without any real relationship to dealing with a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's my argument as well, as in the book, that when historians will sort of point to the coming of the war, as a justification in some ways, as the reasonable relationship between the killing and what came later, I think there isn't any. I think basically he didn't prepare the country for war. He made it much, much weaker. And as a result, I don't think, I think that Stalin's killings are very different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. Well, let me actually concentrate, again, before we move on to the crimes themselves, on one other question, which is often asked about the genesis of Stalinism. There are those, I don't want to personalize it, but there are those who will argue that when you attempt to follow Marxism to its logical end, that is, you attempt to build a communist state, this is exactly what you get. That in fact, Stalin was, if not the true follower of Lenin, he was simply following a program that is kind of embedded in communist ideology. This is what a communist state does and looks like.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that point of view. I would not argue, that Marxism was just those wonderful humanistic documents that came out of the 1840s that Marx wrote, you know, which talked about, you know, the flowering of humanity and, you know, the freeing of men and women from their oppression. You know, Marx was also a revolutionary, and, you know, he also had a very hard edge to him when he thought about revolutionary activity. So I don't consider myself, you know, a Pollyanna about Marxism, but I think there are lots of different ways one could have understood the evolution of the Soviet state, you know, after Lenin. I don't believe, for example, that any other or very few of the other potential leaders of that Soviet state, except for Stalin, would have undertaken the kind of mass killing that he undertook. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking again about millions of people who were killed. I just don't believe that that was inevitable. I don't think the evidence is there that that was inevitable. You know, once the Bolsheviks had seized power, I think there were potentialities, in other words, within the Soviet state that could have taken it in a different direction. You know, I'm not someone who believes in inevitability in history. I think contingency is very important, and I think that particular contingency, that it was particularly Stalin who came to power, right at the end of the 20s in this struggle for power. It didn't have to be him who came to power. Not only that, you know, who knows? Somebody could have taken a shot at him and killed him. That would have been, you know, somebody did it at Kirov. Mm-hmm. We think that was ordered by Stalin, but we're not really sure about that. But the point is, this did not have to happen any more than the Holocaust had to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, if someone had mercifully taken out Hitler in 1936, you know, there were a lot of anti-Semites in charge of the Nazi government, to be sure. But I don't think one would have seen the same kind of evolution that happened. So similarly, in the case of Marxism, you know, Marxism has certain, you know, hard-edged revolutionary elements to it, which Lenin then took to another power, right, of hard-edged revolutionary elements. But Stalin took it, I think, beyond Marxism, beyond Lenin, into a place where a kind of evil was omnipresent. I mean, historians don't like to use the term evil, but it doesn't bother me, I have to say.
Okay. All right, let's begin to talk about the crimes themselves. What is dekulakization, and why should we consider it genocide? Why did Stalin embark on this campaign?
Okay, I mean, you'll notice in the book that I don't sort of label things genocide or not. I tend mm-hmm. to say they're genocidal, or they could be considered genocide, or they could be included in a package of what might be considered genocide. I try to be careful about being too didactic about all of this. But as you know, again, you're knowledgeable in this field, so it's, you know, I feel slightly awkward lecturing to you about this.
Oh, no, please go ahead.
But you know, collectivization was meant, you know, to essentially break the back of the independent peasantry in Russia, to force peasants to turn over the product of their labors to the state so that the state could export grain and use that income to invest in industry. I mean, it was part, you know, of an industrialization plan, and also a plan, as I said, to politically bring the Russian peasantry completely under control. As part of that plan, the idea was, I mean, there was this sort of idea that out there in the countryside, and this, by the way, was shaped and colored by Marxist and Leninist lenses, that out there in the countryside, there were these rich peasants the so-called kulaks, you know, because they held gold in their hands, which they had exploited from the kulak means fist in Russian, and they was, you know, in these fists were full of coins, right? And they had exploited their other peasants, and that a sort of class conflict in the countryside would be roused, the poor peasants and middle peasants against the so-called rich peasants, that would aid collectivization, because the rich peasants, of course, would be opposed to collectivization. You know, what happens in fact is that the peasants are attacked as a whole. There's a kind of civil war in the countryside, in a series of waves in the early 1930s that see some, let's say, more well-to-do peasants, there are hardly any rich peasants, as well as others who simply opposed collectivization were labeled kulaks, as well as whole villages were sometimes labeled kulaks, priests were labeled kulaks. These people were attacked from the outside, I mean, and, you know, by policemen from the city, sometimes by groups of workers who were armed, sometimes by poor peasants, vagrants, drunks, and others. They were attacked. Some were summarily tried by troikas and shot. About 30,000 were shot. Another 2 million or so were exiled, and many millions of others were just driven from their homes to other parts of the country. Now, in shooting, so that's the, you know, that's the rough picture of what happened. Mm-hmm. Why would one call this genocidal? Well, first of all, what Stalin does and what the leadership does is identify kulaks as a class, even though they're not a class. In other words, they put a kind of social stereotype on them. They identify them as sort of inferiors, as animals, as insects, as inferior, you know, half ape kinds of people. They say, we're going to wipe out this class. We're going to eliminate this class, much as you would say, I'm going to eliminate or kill off an ethnic or national group. And they proceed to do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, they do it in part by execution, in part by sending them, you know, to these awful places of exile in the Gulag, some of them to special settlements. And these special settlements are basically places where people are meant to die. They're cut away from society and meant to die. And then later in the decade, I mean, this happens immediately, right? And then later in the decade, there's this famous order 00447. In which kulaks play a prominent role being identified. Those remaining kulaks are identified, you know, by the government as enemies of the people, and many tens of thousands are shot again, and others are exiled. So you have a situation where, you know, the kulaks are cut out. They're in some ways created by the Soviet government as a social group. They're cut out from society as a whole. Even their children are identified as kulaks, you know, parents, wives, cousins. I mean, they're considered a group by the Soviet authorities, led by Stalin, and then eliminated. So, you know, my view is that's a genocidal action. You know, something where a group is killed, put into, you know, situations in which they'll die, you know, by the tens, the hundreds of thousands, and they do die. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And therefore, I think of that as a part of the whole genocidal program of Stalin in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's actually move on to the second episode of mass killing that you deal with, and that's the Holodomor, you call it the Ukrainian killer famine, I think. Is that right?
The Ukrainian what?
You call it the Ukrainian killer famine. Is that right?
Yes.
Why the interjection of the word killer? Why not just the Ukrainian famine?
Okay. Again, there's some controversy about whether the Ukrainian famine should be considered genocide. Many Ukrainians believe that it was genocide. Others do as well. And the real question here is there was, in part as a result of collectivization and dekulakization, there was a terrible famine, right, all over the Soviet Union in this period. Some areas were hit worse than others. And Kazakhstan was hit very badly by a denomadization campaign, a sedentarianization, but they're making the nomad population sedentary, and Ukraine, and Kuban, which is heavily inhabited by Ukrainians, was also hit extremely hard. So the question is, then, why do you consider this, as you say, genocidal or a killer famine versus the famine in the rest of the country? And there are several reasons for this. First of all, from all the evidence we have, it looks like Stalin purposefully allowed Ukrainian peasants to die. The reason you can say this is because some peasants, I mean, the cities in Ukraine were not doing well either. Kharkiv, Kiev, and others. But there was enough food in those cities to keep people alive. The countryside, there wasn't. And they wouldn't let people go from the countryside to the cities. That's first of all. Second of all, they couldn't leave Ukraine to seek relief in other parts of the city, in other parts of the country. I mean, when Ukrainian peasants tried to get on a train or tried to just leave, march out of the country, out of the Ukrainian Republic, they were stopped and returned to their home villages, which was basically a death sentence. A requisitioning of grain was increased during the course of the famine rather than decreased. In other words, in Ukraine in particular, Stalin looked at the peasants as resisting collectivization. It was their own fault, he said, that they starved. And therefore, they should just die. I mean, that was basically his point of view. And rather than accept any responsibility himself or the government accept any responsibility themselves, folks like Kaganovich and Molotov, Stalin's deputies, put increasing pressure on Ukrainian peasants. There was a grain reserve in the Soviet Union that could have been used, to relieve the suffering. And again, death by hunger and death by starvation. And there was, by the way, widespread cannibalism that everybody knew about. I mean, this was not a secret. They were shooting people for cannibalism, but they couldn't stop it. There was even, some people think, a market, in human flesh. All of these things, could have been relieved by the Soviet government if they had used their grain reserve and not insisted on the requisitions and not insisted on exporting. We don't see this same kind of sort of brutal indifference to the suffering of the Russian peasants. that we see in the case of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. You know, there was offers of help from outside, routinely turned down by Stalin. So the situation in Ukraine was much, much worse, first of all. Second of all, Stalin and the Soviet leadership made absolutely no efforts to relieve the death and hunger that was besetting mostly Ukrainians, by the way, not all Ukrainians in Ukraine. I mean, meaning there were some Germans and Jews and Russians and others who suffered in Ukraine. But it was primarily an effort, you know, to get the Ukrainian peasant. And in that sense, I think the Ukrainians are right to call it genocide. And we know in the end, I mean, again, estimates vary, but most reasonable scholars will say that 3 to 5 million people died, you know, in horrible circumstances. Again, it's not great to be shot, right? I mean, that's not a nice way of dying either. But to die of hunger and starvation, you know, these villages simply expiring, you know, with no way out, is a horrible human tragedy of enormous proportions, which I believe that Stalin and think that Stalin and the Soviet government was responsible for.
So let's move on to the third, very quickly, the third set of events that you deal with under the rubric of genocide, and that is one that I think that many people don't know about, and that is the removal of nations, these campaigns for ethnic cleansing and resettlement that went on in the late 30s and through the 40s. And here we're talking about the ethnic Germans and the Poles, the Chechens, the Crimean Tatars, and so on and so forth. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Okay. There were a series of episodes in the 1930s that saw, you know, the attack on nations in the Soviet Union and Stalin's attack on nations. Once again, I would suggest that these attacks were, you know, completely unjustified by the threats that were claimed in all of these cases. You know, the Poles were, and Germans were singled out in 1934 already as potential enemies. The Poles in particular were seen by Stalin, you know, as conspiring against the Soviet Union. I mean, he continually claimed, as did people in his government, that the Pilsudski government in Poland, you know, was trying to undermine the Soviet Union, and was, you know, there were all these plots and agents and things like that. And while there were some of these things, on the whole, this was wildly exaggerated, way out of proportion to what actually happened. So Poles then, and there was a considerable number, hundreds of thousands of Soviet Poles and Germans, were singled out, you know, tried, in some cases shot and deported. There were a series of these actions that continued throughout the 30s. Again, they began in 34. They continued during the Great Purges themselves in 37 and 38, when once again Poles were isolated, Germans were isolated as enemies of the Soviet government. Poles were removed from many of their positions in the government. I mean, there were many Soviet Poles in the NKVD, for example, in the police. They, too, were taken out of their positions, tried, and shot or exiled as enemies of the people and as, you know, people who were trying to overthrow the Soviet government, and as agents of Poland and Japan. I mean, for a variety of reasons, Japan was dragged into this as well. Then there were the Koreans who lived in the Far East. And Stalin did have some worries about the Japanese. I wouldn't say he didn't have any worries about the Japanese, But again, these worries were exaggerated way beyond belief, way beyond any real threat. I mean, during the Great Purges, the whole railway administration was purged because a few Japanese had been involved in trying to modernize Soviet railways in the early 30s. In any case, the Koreans were deported en masse from their homes in eastern Siberia to Kazakhstan. Many died. Many suffered when they arrived in place where there was no housing for them and no food for them, no jobs for them. This was took place in 1937. It was the first major deportation of a whole nation en masse. During the war itself, Stalin in some ways finished the job with the Poles in the famous, what we call the Katyn Forest Massacre, which was much bigger than in Katyn himself, where 22,000 Polish officers who came under Soviet control during the Soviet takeover of their part of, Western Ukraine, Western Belarus, Eastern Poland, as a result of the Nazi-Soviet pact, these 22,000 Polish officers were taken out and shot, one could call it a genocidal murder, because the idea was to decapitate the Polish nation and make them incapable of, of leading and reconstituting their own country. This is very similar to what Hitler did in the part of Poland that he took over in an operation, where some 60,000 Poles were taken out right away, leaders, officers, administrators, teachers, priests, and others were taken out and killed. So you have both the Soviet government and the German government, engaging in genocidal actions against the Poles. Poles were also deported, by the way, en masse from Western Belarus and Western Ukraine. Estimates range 200,000, 300,000 or more deported to the Gulag, where many, many died there. So the campaigns against the Poles, in other words, were ongoing, and I think should be considered as genocidal campaigns. The idea was to just get rid of Poland and Poles as best you could.
Yeah, I think this, of all the cases...
I was going to say,
of all the cases, this one seems definitely the most clear-cut under the old definition.
Right. And then in 1944, the peoples of the Northern Caucasus were deported en masse. And when I say en masse, I mean whole nations. I mean all of them, right? I mean, when you talk about the Chechens, Ingush, we're talking about nearly 500,000 people picked up out of their homelands, accused of alleged collaboration with the Nazis. Same thing with Crimean Tatars. We're talking about fewer people in that case, but all of the Crimean Tatars, some 190,000 altogether, picked up and then deported, to Central Asia. And once again, it's a very interesting and sad story, where the idea is, and we know this from the documents, they're supposed to have shelter and work and clothing and other things waiting for them, and when they get to where they're going, there's nothing. And, they die, by the tens of thousands. And the question, of course, is this genocide? And, Chechen historians and Tatar historians say yes, because substantial portions of their nations, are killed off by these deportations, either by the transport itself, which was horrible in the conditions, or when they get there, there's nothing there. There's not a lot of documentation which shows that Stalin or Beria or the Soviet leadership intended them to die. But when they get there, there's nothing available for them to live on. So, you know, there's a real question in my mind, and I bring it up in the book, about whether this could also be considered genocide.
Well, let's go on and talk about the fourth episode very quickly, and that is the one that I think is the best known of all of these horrific acts, and that is what is called the Great Terror. Could you talk just a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, here you have, again, sort of like the de-Kulakization action, you know, the Soviet government actually creating alleged political groups, right? And these political groups, in theory, in the elaborate plots, you know, are described, whereby the leaders of both, great leaders of Bolshevism, those who are still alive, you know, Bukharin, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Radek, whole groups of these people, these famous Bolsheviks, are involved in elaborate plots, usually with outside support, with Trotsky. Trotsky's mentioned in every plot, as well as the Japanese and the Poles and the Germans, are involved in these elaborate plots to overthrow the Soviet government, to kill Stalin, to take over the country. The Great Purges, you know, spread. I mean, these three major groups were tried in show trials, and, you know, people from all over the world came. Some people actually believe that these were genuine conspiracies, genuine political groups out to eliminate Stalin. And as we know, the number of accused spread and proliferate. You know, these people's friends, their relatives, their associates at work, then their friends and relatives and associates to, you know, get swept up in this vortex of killing, accusations, denunciations, torture, and exile. You know, in the end, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who then are swept up in these purges, the so-called Great Purges. Associated then with that is the you know, mass killing of army officers, of the leaders of the Soviet Army, of the leaders of the railway administration, you know, down to the engineers. You know, whole bureaucracies are wiped out. The nomenklatura, you know, the party leadership is destroyed, along with their friends, their families, their associates, in this, again, you know, tornado of mass killing. Now, the question of genocide, I think, is a much harder one here. Because we don't really, in the case of the Kulaks, in some senses, a group did emerge, a social group did emerge out of this. In the case of these killings, even though they're focused on alleged political groups, there's really no commonality between these people whatsoever. I mean, the Great Purges were one of the most, I mean, if you can say it, one of the most lunatic, you know, parts of Stalin's mass killings. At the same time, again, I make the argument, and I think it's right, that there is a genocidal aspect to this, that killing off your own people, you know, killing off alleged political groups of your own people, you know, and their families and their associates and their friends, you know, has a real genocidal aspect to it. So I include this, you know, in this whole, in this, as it were, you know, group of the genocidal actions, because I think it has certain characteristics of genocide, even if it were very hard, given its completely lunatic aspect. You know, to pin a kind of you know, to make a genocidal plot out of it.
Mm-hmm. You conclude the book by talking about the comparison of Stalin and Hitler. How do you compare them? Are they comparable? How should we judge their activities relative to one another?
Okay, I mean, it's a good question. It's one historians are increasingly grappling with, I'm happy to say. I mean, there was a while when the subject was sort of untouchable. And now it's not untouchable anymore. There are a number of good studies. There are a number of very intelligent comparisons that talk about both the similarities and differences between Hitler and Stalin. You know, my view is that the similarities, especially the kind of structural similarities, structural slash historical similarities, are too strong to ignore, and one has to really take those into account. And that is the fact that in the 1930s and 40s, there are these two enormously powerful dictators, you know, who caused the mass killing and the mass death of huge numbers of people, both within their own societies and outside their own societies. Now, clearly, Hitler does most of his killing outside of German society, and Stalin does most of his killing within Soviet society. So that's, you know, that makes for important and significant differences. But they're both killers. They both control mechanisms, you know, institutional mechanisms that are able to carry out their will. I mean, you know, Leni Riefenstahl called it triumph of the will in Hitler's case. And in some cases, in some senses, you could call this the triumph of Stalin's will. You know, they both were able, you know, to control these states and to build them in such a way that they responded to their needs and to their wishes mm-hmm. and to their wills. And they did. I mean, the other, you know, area of comparison, of course, has to do with their ability also to lead people. I mean, you know, Hitler was obviously a charismatic leader of one sort, you know, someone who could move the German people and could convince them that his visions should be theirs. Stalin was a different kind of leader, but he had his own charisma. I mean, he had, as you know, his own cult. He had a way of convincing people that what he was doing was right and was in their own interests. So even in a situation in the 1930s, you know, where your own relatives are being taken away, you know, to the gulag or being shot, sometimes you actually believe that they're guilty. So both of their abilities as leaders, you know, I would, you know, I think the totalitarian school and Hannah Arendt had a lot to say about mm-hmm. this. You know, again, I realized that they were different kinds of societies, with different kinds of control mechanisms, you know, that Hitler, you know, co-opted important, powerful forces within German society, whether it was the army or industry or the church, whereas Stalin essentially was dealing with a destroyed society and rebuilt it in a kind of Bolshevik image, in his own view of a Bolshevik image. You know, this makes for important differences, but the similarities are really, really powerful to me. And they are, you know, they destroy their own countries. They make mincemeat, you know, out of the lands in between, mm-hmm. you know, out of Poland and Ukraine and Eastern Europe. And they do this in some ways together and separately.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a sad tale.
Yes.
Norman, thanks very much for being on the show today. We really appreciate it. We are about to run out of time here. Before we close, I wanted to ask you to answer our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, What are you working on now?
Okay. I mean, I haven't left Stalin, I think is the right answer. So what I'm doing is a project that's been in the works for a while, really on Stalin and Europe. And this is a different angle on Stalin. And Stalin's an endlessly, you know, interesting and scary person, but he's also very interesting in terms of foreign policy. So I'm working on immediate post-war Europe, trying to understand how Soviet policies were received in Europe, how Europeans reacted to these policies, how they themselves opposed them or didn't. And in doing this, I'm trying to break down the barriers between Eastern and Western Europe and look at Europe as a whole. I'm doing some case studies from all over Europe. They're trying to understand, you know, how it is. You know, what Soviet policy was after, what Stalin was after, how he operated, how he dealt with Europe after the war. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is a piece of Cold War history, it's a piece of European history, and it's a piece of Soviet history.
Well, it sounds like a great project, and I hope that when you're done with it, you'll come on the show and talk to us about it.
Okay.
All right. Well, we've been talking to Norman Neymark about his book, Stalin's Genocide. Norman, thank you very much for being on the show.
It was a pleasure. It was nice to talk to you, Marshall.
All right. Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Norman Neymark about his book, Stalin's Genocides. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.